Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
So there's a new Legends in Lore out, and it's me introducing it this time instead of Wayne. It was about legendary creatures like dragons and vampire lords and things like that. Anyway, like the things that used to be called solos and elites, they're now called legendary creatures and how they are doing them. And it looks really cool. They looks like they're trying to finally deal with the action economy problem by giving them kind of bonus actions that you can spend on things like recharging breath weapons in the case of a dragon, or like a tail attack in the case of a dragon. And they have like environmental effects going on, and
in the case of a dragon?
Yes, absolutely.
Sorry, in the case of a dragon's lair.
Yes. And what else was it? Oh yeah, they've codified rules for the GM to kind of fudge the dice in their favor to make it more fair and or dramatic during the fight. So yeah, I like a lot of the stuff that I see. It's a pretty cool article.
Well, I guess to be fair, the reason Chris kept saying dragon is they only provided one concrete example, which was a black dragon.
Thanks for that, man.
Yeah, a lot of that is based on, you know, what they put. And surprise, surprise, while I like what they're trying to do, I don't like the implementation. Like, Chris, you ran our 4E game, and you said that, yeah, the problem with solos was they have one action to the four or five PCs that are going, and you need those multi-attacks or area effect attacks to deal with multiple player characters. And you also need those like multiple saves to get rid of all the status effects that the player characters used to throw on the boss. Because I remember that one fight we did where I think the guy lasted like one or two or three rounds just because we hit him with absolutely everything and he couldn't do anything and just kind of keeled over. So we felt great at first, but then it was kind of anticlimactic. So I do understand why they're doing it, but the way they're doing it, if this takes, because at the beginning of the article, Mike Merle says, hey, we're just kind of throwing this out there. This is something I did, so maybe it won't, you know, be finalized. But anyway, it just seems like a lot of bookkeeping that the GM has to do, which, in my opinion, kind of sucks some of the tension and fun out of the game. Just, you know.
You mentioned that before. I really don't see it because the additional bonuses, actions that they're giving them, that's really the only bookkeeping part, and they refresh every turn, so it's not like you have to write anything down. You just can remember it, in my humble opinion.
I guess so. Some of the examples I didn't find that helpful, I suppose, when you're looking at the breath weapons.
Right.
Like, is that something that needs to be recharged? I suppose.
Hmm.
But if it's so dynamic and so exciting, why not just have that as something that can be done all the time?
Mm-hmm. Well, in 4th edition, I really liked that you had to roll for the recharge things, because it kind of, I don't know if it's actually true or not, but it felt like it added a little bit of realism. It doesn't seem like something that recharges every turn like a breath weapon, you know, something stuck on a clock doesn't quite feel right. And also it adds a little bit of tension, you know, whether it's going to recharge or not. But on the other hand, you know, boss fights, like solo monsters, are usually supposed to be kind of the big end battles. But if you're rolling poorly and those things just don't recharge, you can completely neuter your monster there. So I can see an argument on both sides for it.
Hmm. Yeah, I suppose. I don't know. And you do have a good point, where at least in the one example we've seen so far, they always get the same number of legendary points per turn. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it isn't a lot of bookkeeping in that sense, but the fact that you can spend a different number of those legendary points to do different things, like, you know, Lyle said you get the breath weapon back, and in one case you have to spend two of those legendary points to get, you know, the breath weapon recharged, and, you know, I don't know, like, yeah, okay, more powerful effects are obviously going to have a bigger cost to recharge or use, but I don't know, I kind of get the feeling that it's maybe not going to bog the game down a lot, but it could lead to GM analysis paralysis, where the GM, off their turn, because this only happens off their turn, is going to say, wait, oh, no, hold on, okay, no, never mind, go ahead, you know. So, I don't know.
I don't know. I think to me, this newest monster, it was a black dragon that they gave an example of. For me personally, it's the best example that I've seen of a D&D dragon so far. And of course, this is without having play tested it. But the reason for that is that when you get into second and third edition, that when you get up to these big kind of boss monsters, legendary monsters, they have enormous lists of abilities. You know, you have spells, spell-like powers, extraordinary abilities, all their regular attacks. You have pages worth of information. And for me, that always led to a lot of analysis paralysis as a GM. But then you get into fourth edition, and there's a whole other can of problems that you iterated there, Wayne. But this one is actually a really nice medium. It has a nice mechanical way of keeping track of all the abilities that runs, seems to be pretty smoothly, and there's not an enormous amount of them to keep in mind. So I don't know, maybe I'm being overly optimistic, because I always am, but to me it looks like a really good way of putting together a solo monster, or yeah, legendary.
By the same token, perhaps I'm being overly negative, because, well, it's me. But, I mean, you did have a good point about the environmental thing, though, Chris.
Oh, okay, yeah, they added on this kind of environmental bonus, I don't know if I want to call it attack, but effects, maybe, where these legendary monsters are so powerful that they alter the environment around them. So part of their profile is environmental, again, attacks or effects. For example, with the black dragon, there's pools of stagnant water inside their cave, and they can use their actions to make these things boil up and like wash out and drown people and knock them over and things like that, which is all really cool. And I really support the idea of having these kind of environmental effects to any encounter. It just makes it more exciting. But what if I kind of want to play a black dragon against type? You know, if I don't want to have it in a cave with pools of stagnant water, do I lose those things? Or is there going to be some kind of, you know, environmental kit that I can use to add together to it? It's a really nice idea, but it seems they're kind of pigeonholing the monsters a little bit based on what they are.
I'm going to disagree with you on that one.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a nice idea. It doesn't matter that, I mean, it's the environment. You gotta work with the environment that you have. If you have like a white dragon, you're gonna be playing with ice and snow.
Yeah.
And if somebody goes, well, what if I want to play a white dragon in the desert? And you're like, well, go ahead, go ahead, play that white dragon in the desert.
It's less that it's when you get into, say, for example, if you want to have some kind of big fighter as your legendary monster, what are you going to do with it? I don't know. If I can armchair it for a minute, what I'd really like to see is this environmental effect thing just as a creation kit that you can add to monsters of any type in any encounter, because it can make any encounter more exciting. And then I just say that maybe these legendary monsters, they get to do it without some kind of extra point cost or something. It's kind of built into their profiles.
That'd be pretty cool, like a legendary effect toolkit, what you're saying.
Yeah, I see it with the fighter. You know, if you have somebody, you know, the Fighter of Darkness or whatever,
mm-hmm.
they have sort of darkness abilities, something to that effect.
Yeah.
But, I mean, certain monsters, you think of a red dragon as a red dragon, mm-hmm. as something that's a beast of fire, and that's what you're going to work with.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
You don't always need to go against type.
True. There was a campaign that I knew a long while ago that one of the NPCs living in the city, he was kind of the mafia boss, and he was actually a gold dragon, and he was kind of, the city was an evil city, but he was, as the mafia boss, trying to, you know, bring in aid for the homeless people and whatnot. So it was a really interesting twist on that. But if they had certain environmental effects for a gold dragon, it might not work in that campaign. I know that's a really specific example, and you're absolutely right about dragons. You know, a white dragon is going to be in a cold place. So it's not that I disagree. It's that, I don't know, it just feels like it takes away a little bit of the flexibility of the game. But it's a pretty small complaint. I mean, I really like the idea overall.
Well, I mean, Mike Marles did say that artifacts may turn creatures into legendary creatures. So I could see like a legendary artifact saying, and here's the environmental powers that the creature gets, and they're going to be generic or darkness powers or whatever powers based on something that fits the artifact, and they're going to be generic enough to be used in any situation because it's going to be carried around by different people. So I could see that happening, kind of hope it does. So
yeah, just there's a big downside if you have generic effects.
Yeah.
That it's generic.
Yeah.
You know, what mood are you establishing?
Generic. Hey, normal D&D. It's like, zing!
Oh, it's sunshine and rainbows. Oh, they're zombies. What?
Sunshine, zombies and rainbows.
Lollipops and...
So anyway,
as far as we went, you're around.
Oh, he's still singing.
Yeah.
Sorry.
As far as it goes, this is probably one of the best legend lores I've seen. I mean, I really like pretty much everything that they did with it, with legendary creatures, though. So, good on you, Mike and crew.
No, I'm just Wayne. They'll probably screw it up somehow.
Good old Wayne.
I watched Dungeons & Dragons 3.
Speaking of screw-ups.
Oh, hey-o. it was alright if you play Dungeons & Dragons. If you approach it as a real movie, you might find it a bit odd. Mm.
So in other words, you should look at it as if, hey, this is someone's D&D campaign played out by live-action people?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, they have like a thing called the Adventurer's Vault, which is a store. And you buy magic items at the store.
Wow, what do you know?
Right, so if you watch it, it's really ridiculous, except that you realize that in D&D, people do that.
Right. Then you're, right. Yeah, I could see that. At first you're like, hey, wait a minute, how come people can just buy regular magical weapons at the store? Oh, yeah, that's right.
It's D&D, and I'm on a prostitute's salary. You're just, all right. And then he goes into the tavern, and, you know, there's all of these... magical adventurers and, you know, a party there, then it's kind of bizarre.
Hmm.
Except when you go, yep, yeah, that's D&D.
Huh.
Does he walk up to the bartender and the bartender say, hey, you know, I got a quest for you. There's a goblin, you know. No?
Well, it's along those lines. Go in there and hook up with this party of adventurers. All right.
That's awesome. That's really cool that they kind of took the tropes and put it into real life and it looks really absurd because it is. I like it.
Yeah, but on the flip side, it kind of makes it, you're like, okay, this is ridiculous. But as Lyle said, you're like, well, that's the way the game plays, so I'm just going to go with it.
Yeah, I watched this documentary on comic books, and one of the comic book artists was saying, is like, there's just some things you accept about comic books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Superman comes into a room, and, you know, his cape is kind of, you know, flapping in the wind, even though there's no wind. Or they all wear these skin-tight costumes for no reason whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
And flexibility.
People just accept it. And then he said, but when you go to a comic book convention and people are actually dressed like that...
Well, that's because the people in the comic book convention don't have comic book character physiques. Let's be honest.
There's that too. But some of them, the kind of those professional cosplayers, they have similar bodies.
So D&D 3, good?
I would recommend it if you play D&D.
Hmm. How many beers did it take?
I love this. We've got a whole new rating system for Lyle. This is awesome.
I just think two. I actually didn't drink. I ate a lot of tacos. I'm always happy when I'm eating tacos.
Maybe so that flavored your... Your movie experience. Oh, well, this movie can't be that bad because I'm currently eating tacos.
Cool. I'll have to check it out.
And I watched the movie The Signal, which is kind of a cult, end-of-the-world movie.
Hmm.
Cool.
And it was okay, just another movie did it much better called Pontypool.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it had some clever things going for it. Unfortunately, the clever things had already been done in other movies.
And more cleverly.
It's also one of those movies, and you've talked about this, Wayne, and about other things where it can get into torture porn.
Oh, right.
And it just kind of the beating up of people just goes on and on and on.
Right.
And it does get tiresome.
Mm. You just kind of like don't need to see it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of that, another segue. Like, I'm all caught up on season 3 of Game of Thrones, and, like, there's some torture porn in that. Like, a lot of stuff that, you know, I'm trying to not spoil anything. A lot of stuff that you don't read, but it's just sort of implied. Well, of course, TV being a visual media, they kind of tend to show. And I found myself, while not incredibly graphic, I just kind of found myself tuning out during those scenes because they were meaningless, you know, in this case.
Yeah, it's like the monster, what you don't see.
Right.
You allow the audience's imagination to work against them.
Right.
And I think that was a missed opportunity.
No, I agree.
And my point is they also have scenes that are brutal in the fact that they show it.
Right.
So you have the nice contrast. But if you're just going to show everything, then you just desensitize everybody.
Right.
All
right,
in this episode, we're going to talk about rune magic. And like our other magic episodes, what we'll do is first talk about rune magic as it was sort of perceived in the real world. And then we'll move on to how it's used or how it's done in, you know, the fictional world, like in stories, movies, games.
Mm-hmm.
But rune magic, I guess when you research that, it's primarily Viking rune magic or Scandinavian rune magic, although not exclusively.
As far as research goes, yeah, when you type in runes, that's pretty much the only ones that come up. That's the most famous ones. But there are other examples, and it depends on how loosely you define the term. Even like Chinese characters and kanji could be considered runes in a way because it's used for fortune telling.
Yeah, I kind of considered like spinning this out into kind of any written system that had kind of like a magical effect. But no, as you said, Chris, you type in runes and a lot of the stuff that, or almost everything that comes up is, yeah, that the Germanic language alphabet, because that's what the actual runes were.
Yeah. So. And in the gaming world, when you say runes, that's often the kind that come up as well.
Yeah, or kind of like facsimiles, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And regarding the rune magic, it seems that a lot of the magic from what it was described is coming from, we've spoken about it before, that just the power of the written word when viewed by people who are largely illiterate. It seems that a lot of the belief was there just because people who could write things down and read them and understand them, it seemed like magic to people who couldn't.
Oh, really? Is that the case? Because, like, were most people back in, like, the Viking Age illiterate?
According to what I read, that yes.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Yeah. No, because I'm not disputing you, but I didn't find that in my research. It just was kind of left out. But, like, even if people were literate, there was a little bit I read that said, or runes were still kind of magical, just because even if you couldn't understand them, mm-hmm. it's still kind of magical how these marks on a paper translate to ideas and things, and
they
can, you know, convey information. So, again, not disputing that or saying that people, you know, weren't illiterate back then, but I think they can hold magical powers even in a society that is literate.
If you want a comparison of a kind of timeliness for it, the oldest runes ever discovered were cave drawings from 1300 BC. So that's Bronze Age kind of era. But and then the runic alphabet system, the Runemal, didn't become pretty universal. And it was never really universal, but it didn't become widespread until about 200 AD. So
right.
There's a pretty big gap in there where there's a lot of illiteracy. But, I mean, when you're talking about the Bronze Age stuff, it probably wasn't even an alphabet by then. So,
right, it was just kind of like symbols.
Right. But... Yes, dates, fun, excitement. But that to the point. I mean, aside from the magical effects of it, that was primarily what runes were for in the early days, were for marking graves and identifying people's property and really defacing other people's graves with graffiti, things like that. But from those specific uses is kind of where the magic branched out of. You know, the marking graves things were too. Keep the spirits either appeased or keep them in the ground so they didn't haunt other people. And identifying your property was, you know, marking it with how much blood this knife has spilt and that it's magical for doing so, and putting these runes on it will make it even more powerful.
Yeah, when you're talking about cursing people or protection, it cannot even be a case of runes. You mean you're putting on, like, paint, some sort of body paint or blood, and just marking somebody. So you could see where just the basic markings...
Mm-hmm.
Where you're looking at colors and materials are the more important thing, and then transferring into specific shapes. So,
mm-hmm.
And of course, the location of where you mark them kind of is an important thing for runes. Well, I think it's the Mayans put a lot of runes around, I'm going to say doorways, but passages.
Mm.
So, I mean, that gets into what Chris is saying, acting as sort of a lock, you know, preventing things from passing through.
Right. Well, that makes perfect sense because, like, compared to other magic, you know, just you think about the idea of carving these symbols into an object, like, that's going to have like a kind of like permanent effect. Like the magic is now there in that thing that you carved the rune on. So I don't know, it kind of gives it a sense of permanency.
Mm-hmm.
So I could totally see, yeah, hey, I want to protect my house. Therefore, I'm going to carve the runes into this doorway. You know, it's a lot more solid than just kind of casting a protection spell on your house. I mean, assuming magic is real, of course.
No, we're not there yet.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, like, back in the day when this was going on, I'm sure...
When it was real.
Yeah, when it was real, you know. You know.
When this stuff just worked. I like your point about permanence, because it reminds me of another P, like the portability of it.
Right.
Which I think is something to distinguish rune magic from other types of magic. Let's say, like, divination. When we talked about the types of divination you had, they kind of, like, just happened. At right. that time, you throw the bones, or you sacrifice the animal, you know, you read the innards, and then it's gone. You know, it's more about the time and the person. Whereas rune is, it's an actual type of magic or something that you can either put on a place permanently, so anybody who passes by or goes to that place, they see it. Or it could be portable, and you can pass on rune stones, like messages.
Right.
And that's what I really like about it, because it, what rune magic reminds me of is cryptography.
Mm-hmm.
So when I just finished reading the book Cryptonomicon, which is not about rune magic, but it's about different types of code breaking and other things and mathematics. And that, to me, is like a modern rune magic in a sense.
Yeah,
which
I can see
exciting
that.
And borrowing from both of those like real traditions, you can create some pretty exciting combinations. But yeah, like the permanence and portability of rune magic is something that's not necessarily unique, but certainly distinctive about it.
Yeah, like I like how the portability you brought up, Lyle, refers to both the item itself, or like whatever the runes were carved on, and on the magical effect. Because like if you did carve like a talisman, you know, which is what a lot of the early kind of rune carving was for, especially for like the Vikings, you know, that's where you see them mostly, like these talismans and protection things. Like the magic didn't stop when the caster died or when the person who owned the item died. It was like, no, the magic is now in this item, regardless of who has it. And it can be passed around, whether someone can, like, steal it from someone else or if it gets passed on from the family. So both the thing itself was portable, and the effect or bonus it granted was also portable. And I like that. And like one of the things I read is that because of that portability, certain people, instead of carving runes into physical materials, would actually tattoo them on their body so that they always had them and they couldn't be stolen.
Yeah, actually, that was something that I thought was really cool too about the whole runes. We can go for another P, maybe popular? No, popular. Universal. Is in other kinds of magical systems, I suppose, ideas or cultures, there's, you know, you have different kinds of totems and, you know, you have your spell casting abilities. But just like you guys both said, you know, once it's done with, it's done with. But with the runes, it not only is able to carry the magic of the runes, but whatever they're inscribed on kind of absorbs or becomes part of that magic as well. So yeah, absolutely, like just inscribing it on yourself, you can walk around and wherever you go, people see this quote-unquote magical nature just by way of having these writings on you.
Yeah, I've tattooed myself with the rune for magic.
And does it work?
Ah, it's a joke.
the
rune for magic in Destiny is just blank.
Oh, you clever man.
Wow, I just bombed.
Yeah, it wasn't me this time.
I think that's one for the history books. Biggest bomb of all time.
Actually, a good example of that is Bragi, the master of all the scalds. Not scarred, all the scalds. He tattooed runes onto his tongue to allow
really?
Him to become the greatest singer and teller of tales.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So I suppose scarred actually works too instead of scald.
Yeah. The scarred scald.
You mentioned earlier, Lyle, about blood for it. And from what I was reading, I couldn't really tell if like writing runes in blood was actually for... It was important, it lent it more power to the runes, or if it was just kind of used for a dramatic effect in some of the mythology. Did you know if there was anything to that?
I read that too, and at least with a lot of the research I did on, you know, Viking rune magic, mm-hmm. there's a lot of references to people using rune magic in, you know, the poetic Eddas and the poems.
Mm-hmm.
But there is not any written system. Like, the people refer to, you know, using runes for divination, but there's no actual written oracle.
Mm-hmm.
There's no written down what we would call spells. There's no kind of written down system on how this was actually used. There's just kind of vague references to people doing it. So, okay. Like, I read the same thing, that, yeah, there's an example of a story, I think it was called, like, the Eggless Saga.
Oh, yeah, the same one I was reading. Yeah,
the Eggless Saga, where... He carves a rune in a cup, and then he cuts his own hand and, you know, colors the rune with his own blood, and that somehow powers the spell. But, as you were saying, Chris, it's not clear whether that was actually a thing, or mm-hmm. whether it was just done for dramatic effect, or whether it was just done because he needed to color the runes and that's all he had on hand. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. While slightly frustrating for doing research for this episode, that vagarity is actually kind of a blessing, because, hey, you could just make it whatever you want.
Very true.
You know?
Yeah, this is kind of weeding into the fiction of it a little bit, but I wasn't really... I'm torn between, you know, which one to choose, because the runes have that important characteristic of permanence, you know, after you die, but blood is not really that permanent of a kind of paint. But on the other hand, you know, just blood magic is awesome, so...
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe that's why runes don't work anymore.
Could be.
Yeah.
So you can activate them with your blood. Well, yeah. Try it out, Chris.
Yeah, let me go grab an X-Acto. I've got a bunch of them over there.
Yeah, I think it's worth thud.
It's like when you discover that the Roman statues were actually painted.
Right.
And they only appear white to us now because the paint's worn off.
Hmm.
So
they were painted in blood. Yeah. Sorry.
Mind blown. No, I was thinking... The Celts, or the Picts, when they depict how they went into battle and they put on that paint and that, those are like talismans, like painted on talismans. And you kind of think, if you're just thinking about the progression, first it was just slapping on that color because they liked the color.
Right.
And saying, oh, that'll protect you. And then as somebody becomes, it becomes more refined, just like art, or when you look at the progression of art, you know.
Until you get to modern art, at least. Then you're just like, whoa, we went backwards.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, let's just go back to slap it on the paint. Yeah, and then they start to develop more rules, and it's like this particular shape.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you don't have a system, it might be just scratching lines, and they're like, well, what if we scratch the lines in this particular way consistently, and this means that.
It's almost kind of like a meme, I guess, in the fact where I could see kind of evolution being a part of it, where it's like, well, hey, those guys with that shape lived. So that shape must work.
You're right.
So let's do it again, you know? And
I lived, so it worked, yay.
Well, no, exactly. Like, as Lyle said, you would kind of like just slap paint on willy-nilly or, you know, scratch lines however you wanted at first, and then eventually through kind of quote-unquote use and proof, they get refined, and that's how you kind of get the system.
Hmm.
Or I guess with, at least with the Viking runes, like each rune in the actual writing system meant something. And had an area of, maybe not effect, but, you know, an area that it was kind of like in charge of. For example, like the rune that's pronounced like, you know, F-E, however you pronounce it. One of them was, the meaning was wealth, and its kind of area was silver, cattle, or lands. You know, there was runes that represented victory, justice, and honor. So I kind of see it like a little bit, not backwards, but reverse engineering. It's like, hey, we have these runes for writing that mean these ideas, so obviously we're going to use them in magic that relates to those areas.
That actually gets into another part of just ruin lore as well, Wayne, is the powers that they grant onto people and things are actually kind of secondary to their use back in the day. They were more used for divination purposes, in which case there was a much more codified sense of what each one meant, because that was kind of passed down through tradition, through different tribes and such. And each one had meanings, like, as you mentioned, like wealth or victory, and as you would kind of cast the runes or however the different tribes use their divination techniques, then whatever runes were pulled, you would tell the future with.
Yeah. I think at least in Viking mythology, that was called spa magic, mm-hmm. where you kind of like did divinations. And yeah, you, as we said at the beginning, kind of used the runes to divine the future. But mm-hmm. again, even though there's lots of references to people casting lots or using the runes to figure out, you know, what would be advantageous courses of action, there's no surviving record of how that happened.
I read a couple of them that were accounts, that, though maybe I misread them and they weren't actual ones. There was some were saying that they would cut down a kind of a virgin tree and they would scratch the runes into the freshly cut limbs, and then whoever the seer was, they would kind of look up to the heavens and draw three different runes, and then depending on what the readings are, then that would be how they would take their course of action, or whether they would continue with the course of action.
Oh, yeah, I read that too, and I guess maybe I presented that wrong, but I guess you compare that to the I Ching, where we can still perform that ceremony, mm-hmm. right? We know how that works, and there's people who still do it. Like, yeah, okay, you cut the strips of bark, you scratch the runes into it, you pick three, but I don't think there's really, like, any...
For lack of a better term, codex.
There's no codex that tells you what the things mean. You know?
I think that may be by design, or at least by evolution, in that it's kind of like a horoscope. You can read a lot of whatever you want into the different runes' meanings. I think that's a feature, not a flaw.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe I'm not understanding you. Certain runes would have certain meanings.
Right.
And would have certain functions.
I guess what I'm saying is, like, you compare that to something like the tarot deck or the I Ching, where I could actually go to the library and pick up a book that tells me how to perform this thing and how to read whatever the ceremony generates. I do not think there's any surviving written record of how to read rune oracles for Viking spa magic.
Okay, so for Vikings. Because, yeah, there are some systems, but not necessarily for...
Yeah, I don't know how authentic they are, but there are definitely plenty of books about how to do rune readings.
And I think those all kind of popped up around, like, you know, the Viking revival, which, mm-hmm. again, it's all like kind of like secondhand information. Sorry, yeah. I did not mean to imply that any and all oracle, you know, performances using runes we don't have accurate information of.
Speaking of Viking revivals, oh my lord, all the New Age crap around runes. It's terrible. Horrible. Couldn't do any research on this episode without turning up crystals and psychic powers and crap.
I'm surprised you haven't brought them up.
Sorry, that was my rant for that one. I read this one. I emailed you guys about it earlier. There was this Q&A interview with this rune quote-unquote master named D. Jason Cooper, and somebody asked, what's a good runic spell for a little girl who has leukemia? And instead of, like, saying something, you know, you should maybe take her to the hospital, he said, oh, well, here, you have to spell out leukemia with the runes, and then you cast them in this direction. It's like, it was. It made me angry.
How do you know it didn't work?
Yeah. Anyway,
Well, were they saying in place of?
They didn't mention the hospital at all. But it's kind of like I really wish that he would have written in there, you know, just in case you haven't taken your daughter to the hospital yet, please try it.
Yeah,
it would have been nice.
But while you're doing that, like, you know, put the runes on her while she's getting her chemo.
Exactly.
Yeah, this works really well with radiation.
Here's the rune for radiation.
This guy, this D. Jason Cooper, I looked him up too. He's a two-time professional wrestler, but he hurt his knee, so that's how he got into rune magic.
Hey, maybe you should put some runes on that knee. Rhyme that career.
That was before he learned how to do rune magic.
I mean, so that covers rune magic when we were thinking about a society that primarily believes or is superstitious enough to believe that it does have some sort of effect.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But it did carry over into, like, certain occult revivals, and we touched on that, and that's when they started to, you know, codify it, like in the 17th century or in the 20th century with, like, the neo-pagism or mm-hmm. failed NFLism or wrestlingism, whatever that guy was. So, Wayne, you were talking about the Nazis and their occultism. They went back to rune magic.
Yeah, I guess like Heinrich Himmler being fascinated with all that kind of like German mysticism and weird occult stuff like that. He was interested in runic symbolism, and so the Schutzstaffel insignia was actually two Sig runes, which Sig kind of looks like an S, but it's also the rune for victory. So, you know, putting them together, hey, it's SS, and it also says victory, victory. So, you know, it sounds kind of horrible to say, but hey, as a graphic designer, I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yes, wow. Well done.
Yeah,
well
wow, done, look Nazis. At that. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was actually really excited getting into research about this because I've heard about the Thule Society, which is kind of the German version of the Hermetic Order, because I've heard that, you know, this kind of secret underground mystic society that Hitler was part of, and, you know, they draw all these kinds of occult ceremonies. But actually having read it, it seems a lot more overblown. It seems they were more focused on talking about how much they hated Jews and communists than actual occult stuff. And well, Hitler was only officially a part of the same party that they were also a party of. So kind of disappointing, but it's a good, you know, tagline for some kind of fiction if you want to get into it like Hellboy does.
Right. And I think it's a good example of how runic magic doesn't have to be limited to a fantasy setting. It can be taken into a modern setting or even like science fiction one because, hey, I mean, okay, maybe people don't believe in magic in the setting all that much, but it still has some kind of power. I mean, probably be cooler if it actually did magic, but...
Yeah. No, very good point, very good point. It's definitely not limited to the ancient and fantasy traditions.
I think what's really exciting in certain stories is, I guess, the lost civilizations.
Right.
And just, you know, Chris saying about not limiting to fantasy settings, I think that's done really well in so many different time periods. You could do the fantasy lost civilizations, the Indiana Jones pulp. You could do the planet that has just the mysterious ruins as is ruined buildings, but also the ruins themselves.
Right.
I mean, sure, there's writing, and that's pretty exciting, but things like hieroglyphics and runes makes it even more mysterious.
I wonder why that is. Like, this might be going back a little bit, but I know at least in the Viking runes, the idea or the mythology was that these were handed down to men from the gods, or there had to be like a, you know, a big sacrifice to actually get these things, and therefore that's kind of what made them powerful in a way. Like, rune actually kind of means secret, at least in, you know, Viking or Norse speech. And I think hieroglyphics kind of have that element to them as well. You know, they kind of feel divine in a way, so maybe that's what runes need to elevate them above normal speech. Because as you said, Lyle, kind of regular writing, yeah, okay, it has a certain kind of magic, but what makes runes special, and what would you need to give a runic magic system to make it special in a modern or science fiction setting? Maybe that kind of divine connection.
So, well, I think you've already like hit upon it early in the episode when you talked about the permanence. Just if you write something down on a piece of paper, I mean, or now digitally, you send an email. I mean, even that is less permanent than paper in our minds.
Right. Until you clean out that inbox.
Well, no, but like what people are writing on Twitter and things like that, it's like people have lost that sense of permanence and or just anything that comes to your mind, let's just write it in an email or on your Facebook account or whatever. Right. But if you were to give somebody like a chisel and a hammer and put them in front of a stone and say, well, write something, I think the person's going to give pause, I would hope.
And ask, why the heck am I doing this?
Yeah. Maybe try to spell it correctly. But yeah, no, it's like, I think when we look at that, and we are a literate society, and if when we see stuff written on rocks, we're like, hey, that must be important for them to have written that on that piece of stone. A lot of times we find out it wasn't. It was just like kind of an inventory.
Or Roman graffiti. You're like, wow.
Yeah.
Or with graffiti in that. I mean, we haven't lost. Like, we want to write on something. We want to leave that permanence. You know, that permanent reminder. And if we go, I mean, and of course, digital records and paper records, they just get destroyed over time. So it's the runes that last.
It's the runes that
I like that.
From a design perspective, too, the runes kind of carry a little bit extra weight to it. You know, if you are kind of exploring through some ruins, R-U-I-N-S, and you see this wall, stone wall that has, you know, all this text carved into it, it looks like something maybe important, but it could just be instructions for it or a list of the locations or whatever. But if you see this one big intricate symbol up there, and that symbol, it's important. There's something special about it. It carries a little bit of magic just by showing itself all alone. So
right.
I think that's something else that runes carry with them. In addition to their mystery, they look special.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, people like to write the Chinese characters and get them and get them tattooed on their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Even, like, you say, well, would you like to write strength or strong? And you're like, nah, not really, but hey, well, can you put that kanji on there?
Mm-hmm.
And if they're lucky, the tattoo artist will actually write the correct kanji.
yeah, for strength, yeah.
Yeah. What's the kanji for douchebag? Hey, check your arm.
Because
it is that, like, compact pictogram.
Mm-hmm.
People like that.
Yeah.
And it is powerful. Yeah, and I think that's also good. I mean, that's why people really probably still respect graphic design and fonts and that, because people conveying such compact and concise but powerful messages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, when you were talking about, like, the giant design scribed on, like, some ruins, Chris, I kept thinking of, like, the glyphs from D&D, and, you know, you're like, oh, glyph of exploding, and you read it, and the whole party just blows up. It's like, oh, they are magic.
Yeah, and I think you can convey and, like, really give your party or your group a sense of mystery and a sense of exoticism, or, you know, you're not in the regular world, but, you know, like, scrawling some runes, and it's like, oh, you see this, and even if you're in a science fiction setting, just seeing things like that makes it more mysterious.
You know, I had an idea that was kind of along those lines, where since some of the runes look very similar to modern English letters, or some of them, they're actually kind of pretty simplistic shapes, it wouldn't be really hard at all to hide runes inside regular text. And I could see that being a really fun kind of way to go with in a modern setting, maybe if it's a hidden world kind of thing, where suddenly the characters gain this kind of sight and certain parts of letters that are just the shape of runes start glowing to them or are able to use, or it's maybe kind of secret language that's written around the city that's only visible by people who are able to use runes or magic or things like that.
Well, that could, I think it's back around to, you know, Lyle's example of sort of codes and cipher breaking as kind of the modern rune magic. So I like that idea where, yeah, there is some kind of message in this text, but you just don't know how to see it, and certain people do. And therefore they have power, whatever that translates to.
Yeah, a nice bridge, I find, if you think to Lord of the Rings and the Mines of Moria, and Gandalf trying to kind of crack the dwarven lock.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speak, friend, and enter. And, I mean that's what the runes are. I mean, the magic's available for anybody who can crack the code.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there's different types of codes, and sometimes they're even, like, I mean, you might even need, like, the Rosetta Stone.
Mm.
And then was that one stone enable them to start to understand what the Egyptians were saying?
Yeah, if you had a group that enjoyed doing kind of puzzles and that kind of thing, man, you could have so much fun with a campaign kind of awakening magic by figuring out what these runes mean.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked about D&D 3 at the beginning of the episode. You know, you go to Adventurer's Vault and you just buy your... he doesn't buy a Vorpal sword. He gets
bad.
It later.
Sorry, three spoiler. Holy Avenger.
Yeah, I don't know. It sounded like a powerful sword. I can't remember what it was that he buys. But you're a party of adventurers and you find a sword with runes on it. Isn't that exciting? It's much more exciting than, I cast detect magic. It glows. Oh, I wonder what it is. Maybe we'll just take it to the store and have somebody tell me what it is. Oh, you know. But it's like it's got runes on there. And you know something, if you want to know what it is, hey, why don't you investigate it a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
Or you go to the NPC who knows how to read runes and have him tell you.
Right, but still more exciting than going to the store.
Yeah, exactly. No, again, thinking of Lord of the Rings, like, remember there's the scene in the Hobbit where Elrond holds up the map, and there were moon runes on the map that, you know, you could only see at a certain time. And again, it's that idea of, hey, the information is there for everyone to get. You just kind of have to know that little secret.
Or even in the name of the rose when they have the lemon juice. the invisible ink, but it's just lemon juice.
A lot of times in prison, it's urine.
Thanks, Wayne.
Yep, you're welcome.
Do you smell urine? Oh, great. Oh, I hate when Wayne Game masters these games. Do you smell poop? Yeah.
Oh, you can see that. Hey.
Good.
Jeez, Wayne.
This one ain't so secret. Oh, but thanks, Wayne.
Yeah, I can see that. Oh, Wayne handed us another blank sheet of paper. Oh, great.
I don't want to touch it. You do it, Lyle.
It's still wet. Giving him a look. Yeah. No, but that also gets into, kind of ignore what Wayne said, but into like different types of materials and incorporating that with the runes. And whether you're using, you know, carving out the rune shape in the stone and you got to fill it up with blood, or if you're actually just writing something on a piece of paper or writing something on the stone in that material, both of those would be pretty cool.
Yeah, that'd be a nice way to kind of play the power of the runes. If just writing it on paper is not nearly as strong as writing it, as chiseling it into stone or something along those lines.
Doing research for this episode, one of the really good role-playing game books that I came across was Vikings of Legend by, I think it's Mongoose.
Yeah, but you had that book before.
Yeah, again, it was really helpful when we did the Warriors Viking episode. I think it's just a great resource. And the way they handle runic carving magic is the person who is carving the runes kind of puts their own sort of personal magical energy into the item they are carving. And in mechanical terms, you know, whatever magic points you have, you don't get those back because you've put them into the item. So that's kind of a way to, you know, limit how many spells they can cast. But you mentioning, you know, it being really important what kind of material you carve them into, sort of because they had that idea of you putting your own kind of inner power into this item, being able to break that item was something to think about, because you can only carve so many of these talismans and then you don't have any more magic power. So, hey, maybe you want to get rid of that one, or, you know, maybe you've cast a spell that is kind of like a one-shot deal, and the final part of releasing that spell is breaking that item. Yeah, there's a kind of a take on the Vancian fire and forget system. Like, it's not that you memorize the spell and then that arcane formula disappears. It's no, you have to carve it into a twig or a piece of bone or a horn or something, and you're walking around with this kind of spell book of physical objects. And then when you cast the spell, you have to, that's you breaking the item.
You just created a fantasy grenades, dude.
Well, I wasn't saying break it and then throw it, you know.
I love it, though. I love it. I want to put it in a pine cone.
It does make a little more sense than, hey, what did I just do? And then having to sit down and memorize your spell book again. Because, hey, can't you just remember?
So. Yeah.
Well, it's no more ridiculous than any other magic, I guess.
Okay, it's magic, so I guess it's, all of it's ridiculous. But
no, but I like your idea. I mean, it could be, you carve it on an item, but let's say you have the knock spell, and you carve that on a lock, or write that on a lock or something, but once it unlocks it's spent, it's gone.
Right.
So, that's cool. Or, you know, you write it on twig, and, you know, it catches on fire, and now you got, like, a light spell for a while.
I was going to think it'd be pretty funny, you have your pouch of components, and all of a sudden the wizard just blows up because he sat down wrong and broke all his twigs.
Okay.
All right, I thought that was funny.
Well, Chris did, too.
Okay.
That's funny. Right. I pictured him, like, you know, just saying, screw it, and throwing his whole satchel full of twigs at somebody.
Well, there's a way to make a, like, pretty effective trap. Just put it on there. Okay, he's going to walk here. Boom!
That's right. You just throw a twig down and let somebody step on it.
What if he was, like, a divination wizard or something?
Yeah, I know. You're like, oh,
the
no!
The explosion is like, whoa, I really saw the future.
Right. Yeah. I saw everything.
Well, I was thinking, like, oh, no, that was the boon twig I put under there. He's really strong now. Oh, crap. All right, I'm stretching it. Hit that high note and walk out.
I think a cool image is like writing like runes on like a starship. It's very Warhammer 40K, I suppose.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think they do something like that.
The runes of the machine god.
Well, yeah, when they do the blessings on the machines as they roll off the assembly line.
Mm-hmm.
So, right.
Yeah,
plus, I was thinking of all the scraps of parchment that Space Marines kind of stick onto their armor that have the blessings written on them.
Yeah.
Yep.
In Phase World supplement for Rifts, they had kind of these dwarven spaceships that were really cool. They're basically submarines, but they're just encased in runes that allowed them to travel through space. They're pretty spiffy.
I'm sure they allowed them to shoot mega damage if it's Rifts.
Of course, of course. Again, fluff-wise, cool. Mechanics, no.
You know, you're talking about the graffiti. That reminds me of what Vampire the Requiem has.
I was thinking that, too.
Oh, yeah. The ciphers, was it called?
Yeah, the different clans have those codes that they can write down. And also the different covenants.
Right, right. Kind of like the secret language, kind of the encrypted language.
Yeah, that's somewhat Damnation City. That source book, so that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets into where you can play with that when you have like a supernatural being and they have different like heightened senses.
Right.
So like what Chris was saying is that you can embed it or hide it in plain sight. And only people who can see in a certain spectrum or are able to actually truly see what's written there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, plus it also kind of gets into the idea of permanency that you brought up before. It's like this thing is important enough for us to put it on this permanent structure.
Oh, like a dragon. Tattoo it on a dragon so that it lasts a few thousand years. But in order to read it, you have to go and find the dragon.
Forget about reading it. How are you going to get it on the dragon?
I don't know. Maybe feed him a lot so he goes to sleep.
That's pretty anticlimactic.
Yeah, I think the rune would be anticlimactic. You know, you meet a dragon. It's like, yeah, but what does he say? What does he read? It's a dragon! Cryptography, they have these things called one-time pads, and they're impossible to crack if used correctly.
Hmm.
You got, like, a person on one hand has the code, on one end has the code, and the person on the other hand has the code. So there's no real system, it's completely random, you just have to have that code book.
Yeah, I've seen that before, it was really cool.
Yeah, I think the only thing really to add to using rune magic in your game is to look at what's already out there. You really need to write down and kind of establish some of the rules of the runes. Because when you look at Viking runes, or if you're going to go with Chinese characters or hieroglyphics, they do have a similarity to them that you can recognize. If you were to write down a bunch of characters, you'd be pretty much able to divide them with a fair degree of accuracy. You know, like these are the Chinese characters, these are the Egyptian hieroglyphics, these are the Viking runes. Because there would be some sort of uniformity to them. And that's just something to do. It's like, you know, hit upon a style. You don't necessarily have to write down every rune that there is.
Hmm.
But hit upon a style that you like. Do you want sharp and blocky like Viking runes? Do you want scratchy and complex? And you get the Chinese characters. But, you know, something to build from.
Do you think you could use runes in the divining sense in a game? Like where the players draw the runes before the game and then based on what the runes are? Because, you know, they each have their own special meaning. Use that to kind of, you know, bend the plot, make it up as you go.
What do you mean? Like the players write the rune beforehand and then the GM kind of bends the story to fit whatever they wrote?
Yeah, well, not necessarily write, because I'm thinking more in the divining sense than the power sense, but like for a rune reading, you draw out, say, three runes and then you lay them down and they either have the positive or, if they're inverted, the negative meaning. So, you know, you could say one is wealth and one is victory and then one is, I don't know, hardship or something like that. And then using the themes that were in those runes, maybe the GM could build the kind of the plot off of that. Or, conversely, maybe allow the players to keep those runes and then at some point in the game kind of throw them out to the DM and say, like, this is my divination token. So the DM has to try and twist the situation kind of in that sense. I just thought, thinking out loud.
In one sense, it sounds like an organic story, your first idea. Mm-hmm. So you have something you've planned. If I understand you, you've planned a part of the story where there will be runes involved. But you don't plan what the runes the players are going to see or players are going to draw. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Either that, or I was thinking if maybe one of your characters is some kind of rune priest or rune seer, that kind of just as a part of the game before a session or before maybe a campaign arc, you allow them to do a divination, and that affects how the story goes to a certain degree.
Okay.
Because, like I was saying before, the runes, they can be interpreted so widely. You know, it's just like a horoscope. You can really read anything you want to it. So I think you have a lot of freedom when using them as divination, as long as it kind of can just be construed in a sense where you're getting wealth. I don't know. I think it could add some depth and some meaning to a runic system if you wanted to.
Hmm. Yeah, kind of as Lyle said, like, if the... I don't know, I think it would be more interesting if the characters, as well as the players, knew what runes had been drawn.
Mm-hmm.
because then it could kind of be a bit like a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know? Like, if the GM is just going to sort of draw these runes and then build the story or kind of bend the story to fit those runes, well, then would the players...
I was saying that the players draw them. Well, not the players, the characters draw them, if the character is a rune priest. For
example. Oh, okay.
I don't know, just thinking, so.
Yeah, I kind of like the idea. I think it needs a bit more, like, fleshing out, because then that kind of gives that one player a lot of power.
Yeah, true.
You know? Which, it is a game, so the characters kind of do have to be balanced, so I don't know. That could be a problem. But
we'll find out, then file that under needs more thought.
I mean, that is how some runes were used, divination, so.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that wraps up our episode on rune magic, which, yeah, I think a couple takeaways there are the permanency of them, the portability of them, and there's the things that you can do with rune magic that you can't do with other types of magic, such as, you know, leaving these messages, these coded messages, or drawing upon cryptography. So I think it's a pretty rich thing to use, and it's unfortunate that it isn't the default in a lot of systems with magic. It tends to be an optional rule, or it's like given to the dwarves because they don't do any other magic.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So. Or it's just kind of like hand waved, and you know, like they did with the rune priest in D&D 4E. Just like it was just kind of tacked on flavor that didn't really have any mechanical effect.
Well, when the bards are doing mocking strikes on rats.
Rats.
Some flaws in the game. But.
Take that, Rodentia. All right, well, thanks for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or you can download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can also sign up and follow us on Facebook or on Twitter, or comment on the website right on the episode, or just send us an email, because we always love hearing from all of you. Thanks, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week, and we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
We'll be right back.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.